From the studios of the Living on Earth Network in Cambridge, Massachusetts, this is Living on Earth Today. It's Living on Earth. I'm Steve Kerwood. The roots to some of the world's first civilizations lie in modern-day Iraq and predate the empires of Egypt, Greece, and Rome. Human settlements rose up within the Fertile Crescent of ancient Mesopotamia, the area between the Tigris and Euphrates River near today's Baghdad. The land was rich with resources and became the... The land was rich with resources and became the birthplace of Western writing, mathematics, and agriculture. McGuire Gibson is a professor of Mesopotamian archaeology at the University of Chicago. He joins me now to talk about Iraq's ancient fertile lands and how the landscape and land use have changed through the years. Welcome.
Thank you.
Now, Iraq, as we know it today, used to be part of ancient Mesopotamia. Professor Gibson, take us back to that age, if you would please, before the deserts took over most of the region. What riches did the land provide for the emerging civilization?
Well, that was one of the challenges. Between the two rivers in the south of Iraq, you have potential to be extraordinarily rich agriculturally, but there is not enough rain to let you have rain-fed agriculture. So very early on, sometime around the 6000 BC, they developed irrigation, and it may very well be that they developed it in the earliest periods in order to cultivate vegetables and things like the date palm, which grew up in that area. But fairly soon they were growing wheat and barley, and they also were herding sheep and goats, cows. They were also taking advantage of the pig and the abundant resources that were in the marshes and the rivers. At that time, the head of the Gulf would have been quite different from what it is today. Going back a little bit further, at the time of the ice ages, the Gulf actually would have been land. You could have pretty much walked all the way down to where the Gulf narrows. And that then began to fill as the ice sheets began to melt. And so it came up to even further north than the present head of the Gulf, although it was probably like an estuary. And this explains how places like Ur, which are now fairly far away from the head of the Gulf, can be said in ancient texts to be right on the water.
Tell me, how did the Tigris and Euphrates rivers shape and influence the way people populated and used the land?
Well, they made it possible for people to live there at all, because without the rivers, it would be just desert. It would look like Saudi Arabia. And one of the reasons probably why Mesopotamia becomes a great civilization and is the earliest civilization we know of anywhere in the world, and that includes Egypt, is because there's so very little in the way of natural resources in the south. And in order to get stone, they have to go a long distance to bring it. They have to bring it either from the desert fringes to the west, or the better quality stone is up in the mountains of the north, or even up into Turkey. Timber would have been up in Turkey and in northern Iraq. Apparently, the main trading item they have is the wool that comes from the sheep and probably linen, which they're able to grow by growing flax. So in a sense, they have to try harder, and they have to work out some rather clever, innovative ways of organizing themselves, organizing trade, and getting products that they can mass produce and send out in ways that other places in more favorable circumstances wouldn't have to do.
Tell me, how did Iraq get to be the mostly desert climate that we see today?
The western desert out to the west of the Euphrates, that has been desert for at least since the end of the Ice Age. There's a one period from about 5,000 to about 3,000 when it's a little wetter than it is today, and there may have been more plants out there, and there may have been more human habitation out there in the western desert. But essentially, that desert has been pretty much the same as it is today for the last 6,000 or 7,000 years. The central part, you're dealing with a rainfall pattern, which responds to the arc of mountains that run to the east and north of Iraq. The rainfall comes and hits those mountains and falls, and so right under the mountains in northern Iraq, there are rains. And the idea that Iraq is just a desert holds only for the southern part of it, in the middle of the two rivers, only for the last 500 or 600 years, when it has been desert, shortly after the Mongol conquest of 1258. The central part of the alluvium between Baghdad and Basra has gone into desert, but it's not a sand desert. It's a silt desert, and if you pour water on it, it will grow crops. And that what's been happening in the last 100 years is that more and more of that desert is being brought back under cultivation, and there have been billions of dollars spent in putting in Dutch-type schemes to drain the salt out of the land to make it cultivable.
What remains of the Fertile Crescent today?
Well, the Fertile Crescent is still there. In fact, it's, with all these development schemes, it's trying to be more fertile. It's Iraq all the way across Syria and down the down that coastal plain of Lebanon and Israel. And some people would even take it down into Egypt, but most people don't under that Fertile Crescent. But, you know, it's, think about northern Syria, which is one of the richest agricultural rain-fed areas in the world, and very, very lush. Northern Iraq is very lush. And think of what's going on in along the whole Lebanese and Israeli coast. These are all quite green, quite fertile. The crescent is still there.
Tell me about the interrelationship between the north and the south in Iraq today. What sort of interdependent relationship, if any, is there when it comes to agriculture and food?
Iraq is a very variegated country. And that variety is both its strength and its weakness. The variety in the country makes it possible for you to live very, very well in both parts. What doesn't grow in the south will grow in the north. You know, wheat and barley grows in both areas. But dates will only grow in the south and only a certain way up the river. They don't grow in the north. Certain kinds of fruit trees will grow in the north but not in the south. Oranges will grow in certain areas. Apples grow in certain areas. Cherries grow in the north but not in the south. Tobacco grows in the north, not in the south. And so if people are trading together, you can have all a very, very rich rich sources of food. Certain types of animals do very well in the north and not the south, and vice versa. It makes a wonderful complement when you combine the two. And in fact, it is that joining together of the disparate parts of the country that has made the foundation of first the Akkadian Empire back at 2300 BC, and later the Babylonian empires of Hammurabi and later kings, and the Assyrian empires of the first millennium, and then finally the Neo-Babylonian empire. When you put it all together, it becomes a tremendous economic engine and a tremendous cultural engine. If it's a bad rain year, you can always – usually the crops in the south are okay because you're watering those through irrigation. If you happen to have a weird thing that very little snow was falling in the mountains of Turkey and the rivers were running low, you can get through on the rain-fed agriculture in the north. I mean, it's a great complementary system.
With such agricultural riches, why is it that Iraq has needed this Food for Peace program?
It's needed it because all through the 70s, when there was this tremendous burst of development, they had put agriculture low down on the list, and they would take care of agriculture later. They were building factories. They built the biggest petrochemical plant in the world. They were building phosphate plants for making fertilizer. They were putting in roads like crazy. You know, they needed the labor. So agriculture was put second. They could easily buy wheat on the market outside much cheaper than they could produce it inside, so that it just made better sense to buy from the outside. And they were buying lamb from New Zealand. They were buying eggs from all over the place. They were buying American chickens by the thousands every month. In the embargo period, which has been there for the last 13 years, there has been limited money for development. They've done several crash programs and an awful lot of new territories under cultivation. But a lot of this is not really controlled projects. It's individuals opening up new fields for themselves, and a lot of that, I'm afraid, is going to turn out badly. Looking at a whole procession of Landsat images, I can see that in the last 2 to 3 or 4 years, they are actually using the drainage canal, which should be full of pretty salty water, and are using pumps to pump out onto new fields right along the drainage canal. So they're getting a crop for a while, but it's not going to last very long. That's going to turn salty very, very fast. So those will, I think, go out of existence. But they've gone from a population in the 60s, it was probably around 10 million. They've gone to, it was 18 million in the last census, and the guess now is there are 25 million in the country. But, you know, that's many, many more people than they have the ability to feed, given the resources they have and given the amount of land that's under cultivation.
McGuire Gibson is a professor of Mesopotamian archaeology at the University of Chicago. Thanks for speaking with me today.
Thank you for having me on.